This evening I'm going to talk to you about a surprise commandment. Now may I say right from the outset that any of you who have attended an extended conference on the family where I've been the speaker, if you attended for the first time that I appeared before that group, it is likely that you've heard this message before. I'm not apologizing for it, I'm merely acknowledging it. Everyone has a certain base on which he likes to build. If he is building a certain series of topics on a theme, as I am this time. And because it's the first time that I have done it with the Free Church group in this part of the country, it is necessary that I give two or three messages that I always give the first time that I appear in front of a group, because it establishes a base upon which I understand the structure of the family really rests, and on which the experiences of my wife and I have rested, and grows out of the kinds of counseling that I have done in the course of the years. Therefore, this evening, I want to talk to you about a surprise commandment. And the text that I would like to use may seem somewhat surprising to you at first, and that is Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6 undoubtedly is the key chapter of the Old Testament. And if I should teach Old Testament introduction or survey or whatever it may be called, I would begin with Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now the reason why I would begin with it is because Jesus begins with it when he's challenged. In Mark, the 12th chapter and the 30th verse, he responds to the challenge. What is the first and great commandment? And he quotes from this passage. Now it's important for you to remember that. And for that reason, I would choose this as the beginning. But it's also the beginning as it relates to the logic of the passage. For example, as you read the passage, you realize that somehow embodied in these words is what God is trying to communicate to the people, Old Testament and New, about himself. A lot of people have the idea that the Old Testament is a bloody business, and God must be terribly cruel and standing ready to drop a rod of iron down upon the people's heads when they begin to turn away from him even ever so slightly. When actually, of course, the Old Testament is a story of beauty and love and compassion. And this beauty and love and compassion is shown in a number of ways. Usually you'll have someone come along and say, that Old Testament, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But you see, what the Old Testament is really teaching is an eye for an eye. That is to say, if you take my eye, I cannot take any more than your eye. Let the punishment fit the crime. And if you take my tooth, I cannot take any more than your tooth. Let the punishment fit the crime. Before this, if you had taken my eye and I had the power to do so, I could take your life. You see, cruelty is the creation of man and the enemies of man. This is not the creation of God. God constantly communicates his love. He constantly communicates his compassion. He constantly tries to save man from the inhumanity of man. When David comes and says, oh God, I want to build your house, God says, nothing doing. You'll not build my house. You're a bloody man. There's blood dripping from your fingers. You've been a man of war. And the man that will build my house will be a man of peace, because I'm a God of peace. It's important that you do not permit someone to distort the Old Testament to mean something that it didn't mean. What did he do for Israel? Everything he did for Israel was for the reason that I loved Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And because of my great love for three men, I am willing to save these people and show all the world by this analogy. By this ensample, says the New Testament in the King James Version. By this ensample I will show all men that I will extend to all of them without favor, without fear, the same equality and the same justice, so that there's no one that is better than anyone else before me. The Bible is the story from beginning to end of the great compassion of God. And that compassion is so great that he holds at bay for 40 years his own people whom he loves, to give the Canaanites an opportunity to straighten out their ways. When Jonah goes through the land of Nineveh, through the city of Nineveh, he preaches that this city is going to be destroyed in so many days. Gets out on the other side, waits up on the hill. All right, Lord, let it be destroyed. But you see, they did exactly what any people can do and also turn away the wrath that is due to them, and that is they repented. And the wrath was turned away. The Bible is the story of love and compassion, Old Testament and New. It is one Bible divided into two testaments. But all of it is the same loving, everlasting God, striving with men. Shall we read a portion of Deuteronomy 6, beginning with verse 4? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. And thou shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. And it shall be when the Lord thy God shall have brought thee into the land which he sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give thee great and goodly cities which thou buildest not, and houses full of all good things which thou fillest not, and wells digged which thou diggest not, vineyards and olive trees which thou plantest not. When thou shalt have eaten and be full, then beware, lest thou forget the Lord which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shalt swear by his name. Augustine read the passage. He got to the verse 5. For thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy might, depending on the translation you're reading and also how Jesus interprets it and develops it in the New Testament. Augustine stopped and read it again. Then he stopped and read it again. He was checked in his transports, because for the first time it came to Augustine that God had commanded men to love him. Now Ken Poor has been making an emphasis here that I hope will not escape us. And that is that we must practice the use of the will. Too many Christians are too reliant upon their emotions, when all the time God is appealing to our wills. Now, there will be an emotional response always, but He is calling upon our will. And He wants us to will to do certain things. And in the case of this morning, God wills that we should praise Him. Tonight, God wills that we should love Him. Now, I'm going to talk about love. And I will agree that most of us probably think about love as Augustine thought about love. And that is this: you either love or you don't love. You know, it just happens. You don't make it happen, it just happens. You know, it's like you're walking down the street and you're not watching where you're going, and you fall through an open manhole, you're in love. That's the way most people talk about love. That's the way we sing about it. We sing about it as though it's all glandular. We fail to recognize that what's happening is simply this: you're walking down the street right into the sewer. That's where you go. But a lot of people think love is that way. It either is going to happen or it's not going to happen, and you don't have much to do with it. The only way you have anything to do with it is to get in the way, in the hope that it'll hit you, or that you'll fall through the hole. Why is it we always fall into love? We never rise to it. It's always downward. That's the way we talk about it, when love ought to be a rising kind of experience, a rising kind of experience. I'm going to talk about three kinds of love this evening. And the reason why I'm going to talk about three kinds of love is that I consider them plateaus. And unless you reach the first plateau, you're not likely to reach the next, and you're not likely to reach the next and the next. And by the way, you could put in about 8 or 10 plateaus. I'm only going to mention three. I'm going to mention the very first one, and then one that comes a little bit later on, and then the one that's last. The one that's last. For instance, I'll not talk about sexual love at all, despite the fact that it's entirely legitimate and belongs in the hierarchy of love. I'll not talk about it. I'll not talk about other legitimate aspects of love, but I'll talk about three that are utterly important to a family. In the development of the family, and especially in the development of our children and our relationship between husband and wife. The first kind of love I call simply the love of appreciation. It's the first kind of love that needs to be taught. And by the way, almost all love needs to be taught. I don't know any that doesn't need to be taught, or at least guided. But the loves that really count, and the loves that will last forever, need to be taught. And the first love that needs to be taught is the love of appreciation. The second kind of love I'm going to talk about, a little bit up the scale, is what I call simply the love of admiration. There is a love that comes as a consequence of admiring someone. You admire the person so much that you know you love that person. You don't really know them very well, but you do know that you love that person. And I can give you loads of illustrations to prove the point. The last kind of love, which is the one that I hope that I save enough time for and get you all over to the dining hall in time for groceries. And I don't really have a good word for it, so I call it simply the love of dedication. It's the all-important one. It's the one you need to know. It's the one you need to practice. It's the one that Jesus would teach us, the love of dedication. Let's take them one by one. First of all, the love of appreciation. Why is it that we are told from the responses of people who are supposed to know, I'm not always sure they know, but they tell us that our present generation, by the way, there are books over in the bookstore that I could draw to your attention where they say we ought to just generally write off the current youthful generation. That's just the way they talk. We ought to write them off because they have lost their way. Now, if they have lost their way, why have they lost their way? In what way have they lost their way? The answer is, if they have, one of the ways in which they've lost it is that they have lost the sense of appreciation. When a mother holds that little baby in her hands, in her arms, or a father, or anyone else for that matter, and they start coochie, coochie, coo to the little baby, and they think that little baby is just a little bundle of love, they don't know a thing about psychology. That child is a bundle of self-centered interests. He probably knows absolutely nothing about love. He wants what he wants. And almost all of the studies show it. Some researcher went among children, planted some microphones all the way around this playpen or whatever it was, and then they recorded what the children said, because obviously that's a good way to find out how the child is thinking. And then they went back and analyzed the language of the child. And you know what the language was? Almost totally. I, me, my, mine. That's my toy. I want to do this. You do it my way. Pow! And he hits him. The point is, that little child is a selfish little monster. And even though it may sound humorous to us, it's the truth. It's the truth. He wants someone to feed him. He wants someone to warm him. He wants someone to change him. He wants someone to care for him. He's constantly thinking of his own interests. And if his mother will supply it, the mother believes the baby loves him simply because he responds to the fact that she's doing the things that he wants her to do for him. He hadn't done a thing for her yet. And he won't for a long time. Therefore, when you take that child, in sin did my mother conceive me, and it's not very long until you can prove it. And there's that little child, and one of the first responsibilities you have is to start to teach that child a little bit about appreciation. Because unless he learns a little bit about appreciation, he's not going to learn about love, because this is the first plateau. This is the first way in which you're going to break in on his psyche. This is the first way in which you're going to break in on his pride, his egotism, his self-centeredness. This is the first way. And for the first time, you even know that when a child, before a child can write, before he can understand very much, and you say to him, thank Daddy for what he's done, and you can just see him, he begins to tense up. No, he won't do it. He doesn't want to do it. And the only way he'll do it is if he's bribed, believing he's going to get something else if he does say thank you now. See? You need to understand the child. And that child is going to need an enormous amount of help from you if he's going to love decently for the rest of his life. And one of the first things he must learn is to learn to appreciate what's done for him. I knew that we had cut through with our children the moment that one of our children, on his own without any prompting, was saying thank you to his own brother. I mean, that's something of a minor miracle. See? We knew that we had broken through. I have actually had persons come to see me, young people come to see me, and they'll say to me, you know, way down deep inside, I now realize that the relationship between my parents and me is off because I have never expressed to them my appreciation. He says, I feel it way down deep inside, but what is there that keeps me from saying it? And one fellow told me the other day, I have never, in my knowledge, told my father or my mother that I appreciated a single thing they ever did for me. I said, do you appreciate? Yes, I do, down deep inside. But I can't say it. I said, all right, we need to deal with another issue. What is it? I said, that's pride. Your pride has become so strong. Because appreciation represents at least a modicum of humility. And until you have learned humility, you haven't walked at all with the Lord. You see, one thing wrong with us is that everlasting, overbearing pride that keeps us from telling someone else that he did a good job, that keeps us from praising somebody else. I wish Ken Poor had 5 minutes more this morning talking not only about praising God, but praising those who are members of our family for something they have done for us or that we have observed that's worth our praise. We need to teach appreciation. It was after the war, World War II, in case you had any question about the one. They're piling up so that I have to display with which one. My wife and I moved to Minneapolis. It was difficult to find a place. At that particular time, we had 3 children. We had taken another little girl from a broken home, and we had taken her brother, who was just going to start college. He lived in the Bay Area, and we were in Minnesota. We took him back with us after making a trip out here because we knew that he wasn't going to make anything out of his life until someone kept after him, so we took him with us. There we were. Mother and father, 3 little children, 4, counting the additional one we had taken, and the monster, my brother-in-law, who had an appetite that absolutely defies my ability to describe anything. 7 of us. We went up and down the streets of Minneapolis trying to find a place to live. I remember going at one place knocking on the door because there was the second floor to let or something like that. And the lady looked, and she was about ready to rent it to me, and she looked past my shoulder and saw all the troops out in the car. And she says, oh, no, I'm sorry, I can't rent it to you. And I said, why not? She said, well, we can't rent it to all those children. And I said, well, I'm not going to drown them. And I turned on my heel and walked off. I can still remember, it was unkind. Next place told me that they could rent it to us and we could have a dog, but we couldn't have 8 children, which I had trouble figuring out. We couldn't find a place. I went out on South Lindale Avenue in Minneapolis and rented the last 2 rooms in a motel in days before motels deserved a name. And then there were these 2 miserable rooms with a bath in between. We moved in the luggage and moved in all of those squalling kids and moved in the monster and my wife and I. And just about that time, my wife sat down on the corner of the bed and began to weep. I don't know why everything looked fine to me. I sat down on one side of her, and her brother sat down on the other side of her. In man's brutish kind of way, we tried to comfort her. That's all right. Nothing's wrong. You'll be all right. What are you crying for? Just about that time, a knock came in the door. Went to the door. There were Jean and George. We invited them in, asked them to sit by the hearth and enjoy the evening. So they sat down on the luggage. And while we were there, it wasn't a few minutes, and they said, we believe that the Lord would have you come and live at our house. Now, may I give you some information? Jean and George had just been married. They had purchased a new home out on Newton Avenue South in Minneapolis. Beautiful new home. As yet uninitiated by the presence of children. The oldest of which was 6 years of age. 4 of them. The next morning we moved in. We gave Jean and George a room. And then we took over their house and lived there from September until the middle of the following March. Until we... What are you owing about? We went through some difficult times where there. I think the kids went through virtually all of the children's diseases. And we had a rough time of my wife picked up one. She still insists she only got one, but I think she had 16. And I can still remember while she was laying there with some plague, I've forgotten what, but she was all broken up. And I lifted David. She was trying to care for our smallest child at the same time herself deathly sick. And I actually pulled David out of her arms and rushed him to the hospital. And they said, he has double pneumonia. We'll see if we can save him. We went through a difficult time. I don't care what Gene and George ever say about me. I don't care what would happen. If someone would come down this aisle with a telegram saying, Gene and George need you, I would close the service and go wherever they are in all the world. Because I love Gene and George for what they did for my family. Why is it that the studies suggest that we have gotten so out of touch with appreciation that if someone does something decent for us, we connive of ways in which we can put back on that person the burden? He did it because he had to do it, you know. He just had to do it. And for some reason, we feel that we cannot possibly be humbled by having someone serve us and provide for our needs. A boy came into my office. Now, everyone who is a teacher has 25 or 30 students, depending on the size of the school, who are very special to him. He thinks of those young people as though they were his own children. I even think that my teacher's here tonight. Is Dr. Nystrom here? Doctor, did I see you, Dr. Nystrom? Yes, there he is. He's my teacher. He is to me like a father. 30 years ago in college, he was my teacher. And I love him. And it simply transferred so that when I got into college, there were my students coming. And this was one of them. And by the way, when you love a person like that, you separate him from the institution. Everything else can be wrong with the institution. The president can be off of his rocker. Everything could go wrong. Well, no, not anymore. Not in the last 3 years, the president couldn't be off. But nevertheless, the point is simply this, that this prof is separated from everything else in the institution. He is, for all practical purposes, your father figure, or mother figure, as the case may be. And in came Andy. He was one of these boys to me. He had been mine for 3 years. He was majoring in the department of which I was the chairman. He came in on this particular day, and it was a bad day for me. He started in, I says, Andy, I made up the name. The story's true, but this is not his name. I said, Andy, enough of that. Enough of that. I said, I've heard the story before. And then he started in because he obviously needed someone, and I was the one. And I said, Andy, I'll tell you what. Instead of you telling me the story, let me tell you the story. So I told him the story of his life back to him that he had told me for several years. He's now a senior, ready to graduate from college. And this is a story that's as I remembered it. Your father died when you were in junior high school. And then, sometime after that, and appropriately, your mother remarried. And when she remarried, she took the four or five children in your family, and she united them with the family that this widower brought to her, four or five children. They ended up with 8 to 10 children on that farm in northern Washington. And after a period of time, the father went to his wife and he said, I'm sorry. Andy and I cannot get on with each other. We've tried. You know we've tried. But he will not accept anyone else to be his father. And he's making so much difficulty among the children and between us that either he will have to go or I will have to go. You'll have to decide. The next morning, the mother took Andy and said, son, you'll go to Spokane. And you'll live with your uncle and your aunt. And you're to treat your aunt as though she's your mother and your uncle as though he's your father. And that day he was taken to the city over about 100 miles away. And for the rest of his junior high school years and for his senior high school years and now more than three years through college. I'd been with him 3 years. He's almost ready to graduate in about a half year. And there he is. And I said, all you've been able to do is to complain, complain, and complain. The only persons in the world that you believe love you and that you love is your uncle and you and me, and sometimes you're not even sure about me. He said, that's right. And I said, excuse me, but let me tell you the way I see it. I don't know how your mother was the night you were born. I don't know how ill she was. I don't know what she went through, because no parent should ever throw that up to his child. We have four children, and we have those four children because we loved each other. It wasn't because we loved the unborn children. My wife bore four children, and she handed them to me one by one and said, I give them to you. This is our love. These are my children because my wife gave them to me. So that the children came to us not because of a great love for the children, but because of our great love for each other. And then the love for the children developed and grew and has become a very beautiful flower in the course of our lives. But nevertheless, I will not talk about that. I'll talk about the worst night of your mother's life. And the very worst night of your mother's life was the night that she had to make the decision between your stepfather and you. I can see her tossing on her bed back and forth. What shall I do? No woman should ever be asked to make a decision between her son and her husband. Her child and her husband. What a terrible thing that a woman should be asked to make such a decision. And the next morning she made a decision, caught between a rock and a hard place. And she decided, I must give up my husband, whom I have now come to love as I did his father. And now I must give up those children whom I've come to love as I love my own children. What shall I do? There's nothing to do but send Andy to his uncle. And so she called long distance that morning. It was all arranged, and it was done. I said, now more than 7 years have passed. And in that more than 7 years that have passed, I dare say there hasn't been a day when there hasn't been a tug inside your mother. A tug that you've done absolutely nothing about. You have no... What do you think of life, Andy? He says, I love life, I think. I says, I know you love life. I know down deep inside you love life. You're glad you were born. Yes, I'm glad. All right, you owe that to her. You couldn't be here without her. And I said, as far as I'm concerned, I have never heard a single word of appreciation out of you for anything. And as a result, Andy, I don't believe that you're capable of loving, and you've promised that girl you're going to marry her after graduation. I don't think you're going to make much of a husband because you have no appreciation. He went out of the door, closing it very much more firmly than was required. And I watched out the window of my office as he got into his car and went out of the driveway very much faster than was necessary. I didn't see him on Friday, and Saturday and Sunday usually didn't see him. And on Monday about noon, into the office he comes, bright and cheery, walking on air. What happened, Andy? He says, when I left here on Thursday, I was mad at you. I said, I detected that. He says, you guess what I did? I says, I'm not very good at guessing games. You tell me. He says, I drove around the city of Spokane for hours. And then I turned the car up north, and I went up there toward the Canadian border, and I drove out to the farm. And I found my mother, and I took her face in my hands and told her I was sorry for over 7 years of neglect, that I thanked her for giving me life. And out of that life, I realized that I also loved her. She put her arms around me, and we spent the next 2.5 days together. And I was restored to my mother. And I told my stepfather I was sorry. And he says, as I came back this morning, I found my girlfriend and I told her for the first time I really loved her. And he says, love has been born in my heart because I appreciate my mother. I could repeat those stories over and over again. Jesus talked to the multitude. And the day was done and he loved the multitude. And he said to the disciples, feed them. And they said, we can't feed them. 100 pennies worth of bread wouldn't do it. He said, feed them and set them down in lots. And they were seated in lots. And he divided the fish and the loaves and he fed them. And we talk about it and we preach about it. It's beautiful. The next day he went around on the other side of the lake and they followed him, and now the multitude is larger yet. Why? Because the word got around. Follow him and you'll be fed. At the end of the day, when he had preached to them all day long, they were just as hungry as they were the night before. And he said to them, "Believe on me for what I am," but they would not. Then he said to them, "Believe on me for what I have said," and they would not. And finally he said, "Believe on me for the very work's sake, because I gave you a fish sandwich." And the response apparently was, "We'll believe on you for the fish sandwich if you give us another one." And he did not feed them. Why? There was no appreciation the night before. 10 were healed. 1 came back. Where are the other 9? By the way, God is not up there waiting for a lot of people to bow and scrape in front of him. He's not an egomaniac waiting for a lot of people to raise praise and kind words and all the rest of it. Why do I worship God? Because I need to worship God. God doesn't need my worship. I need my worship of God. I need to be appreciative so that whenever I sit before my food and I thank God for that food, God doesn't need my thanks for the food. I need my thanks for the food to God. Most of us fail to recognize that. God is as humble as He can be. And He permits us to do these things because these are the things that make us decent people. People worth living with. You see, God is not an egomaniac waiting for us to simply raise a lot of kind words to Him, and He waits until He's stacked up enough to be satisfied. Not at all. Not at all. I pray because I need to pray, not because He needs for me to pray. He knows what He will do. Most of us have turned it all around, and unless you have taught your children the love of appreciation, they are already warped. And you're going to have to reconnoiter somehow. And you're going to have to go back again. And if they cannot thank you or whomever is responsible for the clothes on their back, for the food that they eat, for the education that they receive, for the country in which they live, I have no use for people trampling on the stars and stripes. There's a lot that's wrong with the country, but there is so much that's good. Can I not appreciate what is good and make right that which is wrong? Certainly. But somehow we have robbed people so that you can do 99 good things, and when you step out once out of 100 times, we focus on that. Studies show that people function about 85% well, 15% badly. Our accent now has become the accent of the bad rather than the 85% good. And most of us have lost the sense in the new generation of appreciation. My children better tell their mother that they appreciate what she's done for them. And if they do not, I will not permit her to do a single thing more for them. The second one is that we should love out of a sense of admiration. Somewhere along the line, as a child grows up, he decides that he's going to love someone because he admires them. He's going to admire that person. We could give a number of illustrations of this. I love the Lord because. If you read the beautiful love story of the Song of Solomon, we have this admiration of the Lord, who is, of course, represented in the husband, the lover of the passage. I love him because he is white and ruddy. Because he's the chief among 10,000. He's so admirable. One of the reasons why I love Jesus is that he is so admirable. What fault do ye find in him? You see. Now this carries right over to us. We had 4 children. And I recognized as the children would raise certain kinds of questions as they went along, that they were going to follow Dad and Mom if they felt that Dad and Mom were worth following. If they could admire us. I can still remember the day when Mark came and held his bony finger in my face. And he said, "Dad, I've just come through a time when I believe that if you said it, God said it." And then he went on to talk. He says, "I believe that if you would do it, God would do it." And he says, "Dad, I want you to know if you smoked, I'd smoke. And if you drank, I'd drink. And then he added something, I don't know where he got it for his age. And if you cheated on mom, I'd cheat on you. He was right there, you know. He went to meddling. No. Beautiful, isn't it? I was one time asked to go to his school. And as I went to his school, the teacher met me at the door of the classroom. As I walked in, I was a bit surprised. Not disappointed or shocked in any way, but I was a bit surprised. She was great with child. And we sat down and I said, you sent a note with my son that you wanted to talk to me. She said, yes, I'm going to have my first baby. And I want my baby to love and admire his father like your son admires you. And we sat and talked for a half an hour. She said, I just wanted to see what you're like. How could you have a boy who would love you so much? And say that whatever he did when he grew up, he wanted to do what his dad did. Now, of course, a lot of that passes. And a lot of the naivete and a lot of the innocence is lost. But what happens when they can admire dad or mother, as the case may be? It holds them. During some difficult years, it just holds them. So that when they grow old enough and they have enough information and enough integrity, they can stand on their own. But until then, they need to lean against somebody. And who shall they lean against but dad? Whom shall they lean against but mother? There is such a thing as learning love out of admiration. I used to speak every winter at a church in Winnipeg, Canada. And I would usually be invited by this Scottish woman who wouldn't weigh 100 pounds soaking wet. And she didn't stand 5 feet tall. She was an absolute marvel. She had the Scottish burner in her voice. You could understand every word, nonetheless. And she would always invite me on Wednesday afternoon to tea. Do I look like the tea type? Anyway, she'd invite me to tea. And I'd go to tea, and she felt like she was old enough that she should start the conversation. She would make a production out of tea. I didn't know what a cozy was until I knew her, you know. Cozy's what keeps the pot warm. So she would go through the production. Of course, she made a lot of scurrilous remarks about Americans using tea bags and all of that kind of thing. So she'd make the tea. It was marvelous. We'd sit down, she'd start the conversation. This particular year, she took her saucer and as she was lifting her cup, she says, do you love the Queen? Well, as you know, I have 114 funny bones in my body. And I don't know why it flashed across my mind, but I said, well, I'm kind of a Philip man myself. And she brought herself up to her full 4 feet, 11 inches, and she says, I love the Queen. And I said, well, how do you know? And she says, well, I love the Queen. I says, you ever seen her? Well, yes, we saw her once. She came through shortly after she became Queen. She came through Winnipeg and passed through an arch. There's an arch in Winnipeg that the Sovereign of England passes through. Not heavily traveled, 3 times a century, and that's the way it is. And she says, I saw the Queen from about 100 yards away. So that's the closest you've ever been. Closest ever been. Never curtsied to the Queen. Never spoke to the Queen. How do you love her? She says, I love her because of what she stands for. And then she began to explain to me, and it was beautiful to listen to, of what the monarch of England is supposed to stand for. That monarch is supposed to stand for the best that's within us. And she went on to explain what the country ought to be like if the monarch is recognized for what the monarch is meant to be. It was beautiful, and I believe that she loved the Queen. I've met people who've never shaken hands with Billy Graham. They love Billy Graham because of what Billy Graham stands for and what he's trying to do. I remember reading Vincent Sheehan's marvelous book, Lead Kindly Light, which was really a compilation of the conversations that he had with Mahatma Gandhi. And the day that Mahatma Gandhi lost his life, Vincent Sheehan bid him goodbye. Mahatma Gandhi took his direction toward his prayers. As Vincent Sheehan went out the other way, and he called his book Lead Kindly Light because Mahatma Gandhi thought the most beautiful song that the Christians had ever sung was Lead Kindly Light. So he called it that. But he said in the couple of days that he had spent his time with Mahatma Gandhi, he had grown to love Gandhi. Though Vincent Sheehan called himself a Christian and Gandhi did not, Nevertheless, Vincent Sheehan loved Gandhi for what Gandhi stood for as far as the social betterment of India was concerned. And so as Vincent Sheehan made his way to the left, and Gandhi was going to his Hindu prayers to the right and went past a barrier, Sheehan heard the shots, and he knew what happened in that moment of silence. And he said that his love for Gandhi was so great, and the realization that that frail body could not stand any such onslaught, he said that he felt swooning come over him. His eyes glazed. The perspiration stood out on his brow. And someone asked him afterwards, why? And he says, because I loved him. It is so possible for a father and mother to so live in Christ-like, church-like fashion. In the analogy that we talked about on Sunday night, that our children will do for us what one of our children did. Dad, we know that you speak in a lot of family conferences, and God helping us, we will never embarrass you, so the people will come back and say that your family didn't do what you preached. Oh God, what a beautiful thing for our child to say to us, so that I won't be embarrassed to talk to you. The last kind of love, the highest, you can't get any higher, no matter who talks to you. It's the love of what I call the dedication, because I don't have a good word that fits the series that I want at all. I suppose everybody knows the famous Greek words for love. Eros, phileo, and agapao. Eros does not appear in the New Testament. A lot of people don't know that. It does appear in Greek literature. It is a Greek word. It's a word from which we get our word erotic. It happens to be a good word. It has to stand for procreation, especially physical procreation. It's beautifully handled by Rollo May in his eminent book, Love and Will. Any of you who have any kind of background with sufficient sophistication will read that book with great profit. The word eros is a good word if it's not decayed, if it's not allowed to stand for something other than it was originally meant. I'm not going to be critical of it, but nevertheless, the word is not used in the New Testament. The word phileo was commonly used among the Greeks. This is the kind of love that is brotherly love. You love me, I love you. If you love me, I will love you. If you don't love me, I will not necessarily love you at all. Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. It's the kind of love that the psychologists talk about. If you read Freud, Freud will talk about the love of reciprocity. Reciprocity is simply the word that if you do it, I'll do it. If you have reciprocal trade agreements, that simply means you lower your trade barriers and we'll lower ours, or you raise yours and we'll raise ours. Whatever you do, we will do. And so this is the way you should understand phileo, philein. And then there's agapao. Agapao, or agape love, does not appear anywhere else in Greek literature except the Bible. You can read all you want from Plato and Aristotle and all of the rest of it. Well, I started to say Socrates. Socrates didn't write anything. Plato wrote what we believe Socrates believed. Plato and Aristotle and the rest of them. And you will not find agape. Why not? Because agape is not the kind of love that human psychology can understand. Agape says, I love you no matter what you think of me. Love your enemies. No psychologist can tell you that. Because he believes that it's against nature. And it is. Without the nature of Christ, you will find it exceedingly difficult, even then, to love your enemies. Agape. Agape love. Now, if we can talk so much about agape love, and I hear it a great deal, and in the last 5 years, a lot of people talk about agape love, oftentimes in very unlovely ways, but they talk about agape love. They're talking about the most beautiful love that's ever been conceived, and it's revealed to us in the Scripture, and yet not practicing it. Talking about it, but not practicing it. Agape love. Agape love says, I love you no matter what you think of me. I love you no matter what you will return to me. May I quickly try to put it together for you? My wife and I were married 30 years ago in September. Came to this beautiful place for our honeymoon. World War II was on, so there wasn't anyone around. We didn't mind. We didn't want anybody around. It was beautiful. And then for the next 13 and a half years, we lived as I would suppose most couples lived. I think so. We had what I call high school love. I call it high school love because I had it so often in high school. High school love goes something like this. If you love me, you'll do this for me. If you love me, you'll go where I want to go. If you love me, you'll let me touch you where I want to touch you when I want to touch you there. She ought to know just like that, that's not the kind of love she wants. Not if she's a Christian, at least. Because what he is saying to her is, I love you, now you satisfy my passion. I love you, so you do something I want you to do. Which is, of course, inimical to what the Scripture teaches about love. The Scripture teaches that while we were yet sinners, unlovely, Christ died for us. He had just poured out His love before any love whatsoever was returned. I still can't get over the fact He walked with His disciples for 3 years, half-brawling disciples, miserable on occasion, not listening, divisive in almost everything that they did. And as a consequence to this, one would think that He would get rid of them and choose a more intelligent group. But He loves them all the way. He loves Peter when Peter is denying Him and cursing Him. What love He shows, agape love. We had been married for that 13 and a half years. I was serving a covenant church, which is permissible to mention in a sermon to free church people. And it was a wonderful church, wonderful people. But I was sick up to my eyebrows with my life, with our lives. All of our children had been born. I was counseling others. I was doing the kinds of things that a pastor ought to do. I'd spend time in prayer. I was careful about the preparation of my sermons. I called upon the people. I would drive my car into the garage and run across to the hospital before I even went into the house so I'd make sure that I made my hospital calls and so on and so on. I did everything that I was supposed to do. And I was sick of it. Why? Because I knew that somehow inside I was a hypocrite. I was telling those people to love and I wasn't loving as I ought to love. I had in front of me my Bible and my concordance. I was looking everywhere where love appeared. I had in front of me Drummond's Greatest Thing in the World, his great sermon on the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and I had a few other things spread in front of my desk as I sat there. And then it hit me. How selfish was the love that I thought that I had. How selfish. Always, if you love me, you'll do this. If you love me, you'll do that. If you love me, you'll clean up the house. If you love me, I ran upstairs and I found her in the kitchen. And that was in the spring of 1957. And she had her hair up. In those days, the women looked like they were peeled when the hair was up. You remember they used those pin curls? In fact, it was dangerous to get close because full of weapons. Now they look like they have plumbing on. But that's the way she looked. And I walked over her and I didn't know what to say because I wanted to be sincere and I wanted to get it through. And I thought if it took me over 13 years from the time we were married until this time in the spring of 1957 to learn all this, how in the world can I get it through today? And I started by saying to her the thing I think every man ought to say somewhere after some years of marriage. Honey, if I had it all to do over again, I'd marry you. And then I told her what had happened to me down in my study. And I said, I want you to forgive me. And I will never say to you again, if you love me, you'll do this for me. From now on, I want to love you as Christ loved the church and gave Himself for it. And I want to say to you, I love you. Now tell me, what may I do for you? And she did what she'd always do in a case like that. She started to weep. And through her tears, she said, I've wanted to live like that with you, but I didn't know how to tell you. And right then and there, we were married again. Without the benefit of clergy. Without her mother weeping like she did the first time. We were married again. In April of 1957, 13 and a half years after our first marriage, and what our contract said, and what the preacher said, and what our children say. But we have beached our craft on an island of love, and no one is going to get us off. And we found that love from Christ, agape love. Now, how do you get it? If I should decide this moment to leave this room, my brain would make some kind of contact with the nerves. The nerves would make some contact with the muscles. And the muscles would lift my legs one at a time as I would go down and out that door. It's something that I do deliberately. Love is a matter of the will. A woman will sit in my office and she'll say, "I don't know if I married the right one." I said, "Whoever you married, that's the right one. I cannot understand that you truly understand Christianity. If God gives you all of His love, why you cannot choose to love her, love him, love her, love him." My wife knows I love her with all my heart and soul and being. I would die for her. But if she had never come along, if I know the love of God, I have met 1,000 women in my lifetime. If they would have had me, I would have loved them too. And any one of which, if she had become my wife, I would like to think that the way I understand love now, if I would give the love that I understand now to her, we would have had a happy life. Whoever you're married to, that's the right one. That is the right one. And you can, once you've put down your pride, you can, once you're willing to say the things that you ought to say, you can, once you're willing to take a position whereby you count every other man as better than you, because that's the Scripture. That doesn't mean he is better. You count them as better. I count each of my children as better than I. My wife better than I. You better than I. There's no one in this room more unworthy than I. And once you sense that, you sense a love. And the love comes to you, agape love, love that came first from Christ to us. And He simply said, "Be ye followers of Me." And so I follow Him. And as He loved the church, I love my wife. As He gave Himself for the church, I give myself for my wife. And it's a matter of the will. He that willeth to do His will know. Dear brethren, and I speak to men now, swallow your pride. And take your wife's face in your hands and say, "I love you. What may I do for you?" And she'll say back, "I love you. What may I do for you?" And then what happens? Your children come to you as one of ours did to us and say, "You know why we want to get married?" "Why?" "Because we want what you and Mom have got." I was washing the car one day. I don't know why, with 2 teenage sons, I was washing the car. But I was washing the car. And David came out of the garage door. And when he came out of the garage door, I looked up to him and he started to laugh. I said, "What are you laughing about?" He says, "You thought I was Mom." I said, "Yes, I did." "And what are you, psychic or something?" He says, "No." He says, "You've got to look just for Mom. When you looked up, you gave it to me that time." I'm nothing special, and I know it, and God knows it, but I can love, and that makes all the difference in all the world, and for eternity.